Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, or should I say good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dr. Walter Dean on Getting It Done. We're going to have about probably 45 minutes to an hour dealing with the greatest jazz singer of all time. Look, we had so far Lena Horne, Sarah Vaughan, Billie Holiday, and all of them were great, and even better than great. But our greatest today, that is Ella Fitzgerald. So let's get started and pay homage to this great female singer.
So better now than me.
But privately, Ella was not always the exuberant figure who appeared on stage. Her troubled childhood was kept from the public, unknown until recently.
The public never knew the full measure of what she had overcome in order to become the great singer, the great icon that she became.
But with her extraordinary untrained talent, Ella communicated the sheer joy of singing like no one else.
It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that twang.
Life has a crazy pattern. Comes to
Ella Fitzgerald was born in Virginia in 1917. Her father, William, was a wagon driver. Her mother, Tempe, a laundress.
What else can I do?
My mother had a very beautiful classical voice. They tell me that my father was a guitar player. But I don't know, because I never met him.
Her father died when she was just a year old. With her mother, Tendi, Ella joined the Great Migration of poor black families seeking a better life in the North.
I was a kid about half past three. My mom said, daughter, come here to me.
Ella arrived in the New York suburb of Yonkers.
But this is one thing.
She soon found herself with a stepfather and half sister.
Which ain't what you do with the way that you do it. Ain't what you do with the way that you do it. That's what gets results.
Ella was not a conventionally attractive girl, and she was something of a tomboy, but very bright.
You've learned your ABCs. You've learned your.
When I was going to school, I took an academic course, and I felt that I wanted to be a doctor. But I never really gave it that much thought. And then I started wanting to do something else. I used to dance. I was known as one of the great little tap dancers. But I've always been sort of a shy person.
The young Ella loved to listen to the radio. Among her favorites were popular 20s trio, the Boswell Sisters.
Three nice middle-class ladies, you know. But they made music that swung really hard. And Connie Boswell, the lead singer of the Boswell Sisters, was Ella Fitzgerald's hero.
Music goes round and around, oh, oh, and it comes out.
They gave her a feeling of the music being optimistic and kind of sounding easier than it was to do, and that sort of grace that was always a feature of her own work.
Another of the young Ella's favorites was the father of jazz, Louis Armstrong.
Louis Armstrong, who of course influenced countless jazz singers, because he'd invented a way of jazz singing that really was borrowed from his trumpet playing.
I know the hot need, don't care to go. I'm home about it, be my radio, babe.
Doing an impression of Louis Armstrong was one of her party tricks, and she could do it from a really early age.
Well,
She would revisit it, and it would turn up over and over again in performances.
But as a child, Ella couldn't have foreseen that years later she'd make a series of duet records with Armstrong. They remain among the best-selling jazz albums of all time.
Say, Pop. Oh, Pop, put that horn down and listen. I want to ask you a question.
What's bugging you, baby?
Well, have you ever been in love?
That was something I think she would have been utterly astounded to have considered when she was there, when she was young and learning those things for the first time.
When Ella was 15 years old, her mother, Tempe, died suddenly.
It's here that the story veers away from Ella's own account. Her mother, Tempe, died when she was 15, saving someone from an accident, as Ella claimed, but suddenly and unexpectedly of a heart attack. And the next phase of Ella's life was to be much darker and much more troubled than she would have had us believe.
Get out of town.
While researching an article about 1930s institutional care of black children, journalist Neil Bernstein stumbled upon Ella's name in the records, allowing her to build a clearer picture of Ella's teenage years.
Be good to me, please.
Ella was orphaned at 15. Her stepfather, the man she called her stepfather, abused her, and she was placed with an aunt in Harlem.
Just disappeared.
She got into trouble on the streets. She was scrounging for money pretty much any way she could. And that included running numbers. It was a lottery. It was kind of a racket at the time. She was a lookout at a bordello. I think they called it a sporting house.
We touched too much.
She got into trouble with the police. It really wouldn't have taken much for her to be handed over to an orphanage.
So on your mark, get set, get out of town.
But Ella ran away from the orphanage, although it wasn't long before the authorities picked her up again.
This troubled teenage runaway was the perfect candidate to be sent upstate to a reformatory.
Ella was sent to a girls' reform school in New York State. The building still stands, although it's now a men's prison.
This institution was really a harsh place. There were these buildings called cottages, but they weren't domestic at all. And black girls were confined to two of the most overcrowded, the most dilapidated.
You don't know what love is. You don't know.
There was terrible abuse. Male staff members beat the girls. Discipline was being shackled in your room, being kept on bread and water.
You don't know what love is.
Ella kept this secret all her life. She never spoke about it in public.
She never discussed her earlier years. She was always talking in pleasant tones about that she had a good upbringing and all of that. She didn't ever talk about the dark side.
And there was a price to be paid for suppressing this, in effect. You know, I think that she transcends that pain in her singing, and I think that in her life, it was harder to transcend.
¶¶
It's unclear whether Emma ran away or simply aged out of the reform school. But still a teenager, she ended up back on the streets of Harlem during the blossoming of the jazz age.
Harlem was the mecca. It was the most liveliest place in the world that went on seven nights a week. There weren't many places you could go to the swing scene, at least not for us, because of segregation. So the bands came there, the singers came there, the dancers came there. It was all in one area.
Yes, at that time, was the dance music of the day. You might get a dance beat, and you could also get Coleman Hawkins. You could get a dance beat, and you could also get the Count Basie Orchestra. People could go out to dance, and they would actually get some art at the same time.
Although in the eye of Harlem's jazz hurricane, Ella was homeless, sleeping on the street. For money, she'd sing and dance on corners.
I could dance with people because everybody thought I was a good dancer. I got the chance to get a little more money from what I was making, which was nothing at that time.
Ten cents for dance. That's what they pay me. Gosh.
She told me about when she had started out on the corner with a few of the girlfriends, and she was young. They would put her on the corner because she was a champion dancer. She would dance, people would give money, then the older girls would take all the money and run away.
And even rough guys, tough guys who tear my gown.
She's basically a wannabe talent who has absolutely nothing. She's virtually a street urchin.
Seeking way out of street life. In November 1934, Ella was one of the hopefuls of the Harlem Apollo Amateur Night.
I really went on to try to be a dancer. That's how I went on an amateur contest. But when I got on the stage and I saw all these people, I lost my nerve.
She was going to get on the stage and dance. And Ella was the first one that they called. And she got out on the stage and she was scared to death.
We saw her the first time she ever walked on stage. And ladies and gentlemen, Miss Ella Fitzgerald. And when she came on, she wasn't that attractive. I mean, she wasn't well-dressed. I mean, she was a kid that from the street. We couldn't believe what we were looking at. How dare she come on this stage? Don't we fool her? Boom!
She didn't know what to do, and somebody said, what are you going to do? What's she going to do?
And she started singing. When his eyes say yes, and you're wrong in your guess, that Judy, my Judy.
That time I didn't know one piece of the other, I just sang. And I won first prize. Then I went back trying to win more amateur contests.
After her triumph at the Apollo, Ella was back on the streets. But she was about to get her big break with one of the most popular bands on the Harlem scene, the Chick Webb Orchestra. Webb's orchestra was the house band of the legendary Savoy Ballroom. One of the dancers in his stage act was Norma Miller.
We were a dance act, but we happened to be an extraordinary dance act. But who was the band? The band was Chick Webb. He was the king of swing. He was mean. I had to dance in front of his drums, and he threatened me. You touch my drums, and you've done that. To me, he was a general pain in the ass. But we found out why he was testy, because he was always in pain.
He's deformed. He's a hunchback. He's had tuberculosis of the spine since birth. He obviously was exceedingly ambitious. He perhaps saw the addition of vocalists to his band as an avenue of expanding his domain to Eclipse being the best-known band at the Savoy Ballroom to one of the best-known bands, period.
One of the members of Chick's band, Bardu Ally, had heard about Ella.
And she's standing in the wings with some boy shoes on, eating a hot dog. And I said, I heard you sing last week, and I told Mr. Webb about you. So I said, come on, I want to take your chance so we can hear you. So finally, when she sang, you could hear a pin drop her up, because she sings just like a horn.
Chick Webb hired Ella.
Give me a song that's over, feeling the way I am.
She was under pressure, shaking in every other sense, but being able to sing like that.
If it ain't got that jazz.
She didn't wear clothes that you could wander out of the corner store and let alone appear on a stage. And Chick Webb took all that over. He brought her clothes, he wanted rooms for her. He just took this innocent, unworldly person and put her in the world.
That was the part one of the bibliography on Ella Fitzgerald, with some known characters talking about various elements of her life as a child and as a young teenager. We're going to go on to part two on Ella Fitzgerald.
In the world.
Oh, baby, I don't want you to
I'm a teenager. She wasn't 20 years old yet. Very shy, but get on the stage and she blossomed.
Mr. Trombone, play some corn. I ain't caring what notes. Mr. Trumpet, grab a horn. Brother, give me hot nose.
There was no such thing as I'm not winning over an audience.
Bright and yellow.
The lines got longer and longer waiting to get into the theater. You knew when you heard her sing that she was the best. She was the queen of swing.
The king of swing and his new queen became a formidable team.
Now when I say book for Mr. Rhythm, you all know I mean Chick Webb.
With close eyeing the pop charts, Chick and Ella started to release some records under Chick's contract with Decca.
It was a very ambitious band because we had a very ambitious leader who believed that you could do anything, but felt that I wanted to be a big success in the hurry.
Ella Fitzgerald is on the subtle side. She masks it, of course. It's a lot of people don't think about it right away, at least in those generations, encountering a female. But she wanted to be number one. She was more than ambitious.
And I was fooling around the piano with Chick's fantastic. Used to use it as a game in school. He said that would make a cute little novelty now because people were going for novelty songs at the time.
The biscuit, a biscuit. A brown and yellow basket. I send a letter to my mommy. On the way I dropped it.
It was really considered a novelty song by the jazzers, although the way that she swung it was kind of made it into a very early jazz piece.
I was trucking on down the avenue, but not a single thing to do.
She had this wonderful young voice. A casket, take a child voice.
Just a little yellow basket. A little yellow basket.
In July 1938, A Tisket went to number one in the national charts. Ella was just 20 years old.
I lost my yellow basket. Won't someone help me find my basket and make me happy again? No. No. Just a little yellow basket. A little yellow basket.
Oh, that's the start of her national stardom. I mean, everybody knew who Ella Fitzgerald was after that.
Every songwriter tried to write a nursery rhyme song, and they gave it to Ella. Because she had this hit, they wanted Ella to sing. I think the next thing she did was Bubblegum, which was an idiotic song.
Chicken Bella went on to have more number two hits, although never reaching the top of the charts again. But Chick's health began to fail, and in August 1939, he died. For Ella, who'd suffered so much loss in her life already, it was as though she'd been orphaned again.
They had a very close bonding there together, yeah. When he died, he told them, take care of Ella.
The devil was in your heart, but heaven was in your eyes. The night that you told me those little white lies.
But perhaps because the man who had virtually been her guardian was gone, Ella made an unwise decision. She got married to a man called Ben Corngay, who'd been in jail on drugs charges several years earlier.
It's not a good marriage, and everybody wondered how the hell did she marry somebody, a man from the street. He was a street hustler. And of course, he would be taking her money and everything, and I guess they didn't allow that because she was too valuable, so they broke that up.
She got an annulment, and she said, the judge said to the Bernie Corbett, you leave little girls alone, and told Ella, you just keep singing a tisk of a tasket.
Ella fronted Chick's band herself for a while, but then went on to collaborate with a variety of different players. She had many hits throughout the war years, including this one with the Ink Spots.
Into night, the name of war. But too much is coming mine.
And then everything was to change.
And then jazz was hit by this colossal musical revolution of the 1940s, the bebop revolution, of which the architects were Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Thelonious Monk. And this was almost willfully an attempt to make jazz more difficult than it had been before. Ella was in the right place at the right time. And when she toured with Dizzy Gillespie's group, it was a golden opportunity. She was musically sophisticated enough to understand how bop worked. But she could also take advantage of a quality in Gillespie that, in a way, had been a little like the quality of Chick Webb, too, which was that Gillespie was an inspired showman. He sugared the pill of it.
Stop peanuts.
Ella soaked up everything she heard and fashioned her own way of joining in. Wordless scatting. It will become a highlight of her performances for the rest of her life.
Her ability to elasticize time and be playful with it at any speed is something that she always was able to do. Adding some rhythmic design to it of spectacular nature, that's very fetching.
Just seems to go on forever. But at the same time, you know, not leaving her audience behind and, like, you know, throwing in something recognizable for them to, like, latch on to. The way she improvises, she has the knowledge of a horn player. She's like, ba da ba ba dum ba ba da dum ba da ba da ba ba dum ba dum ba dum ba dum. She's like an instrument. She did it immensely. Then she could go on forever and ever and ever and ever, scatting herself away with all the musicians on stage.
She's taking a solo. She's rolling along.
I would have wondered if you didn't get that room. It's just like something Charlie Parker might have dreamed of.
I saw it.
transition to bebop was a key move in our life. And as we checked that before, it was a move that was sealed both musically and emotionally by a close personal relationship, and that was with Dizzy's bass player, Ray Brown.
When I was with Dizzy Gillespie's big band, we went on tour with her. After we had been touring, she got married. I had an influence on her in terms of better caliber musicians than the ones she had been employing. I was a bass player. She was a singer, you know. And she didn't tell me how to play the bass. I didn't tell her how to sing, which I think should always happen.
The couple also adopted a son, the child Bella's half-sister, Frances, whom they named Ray Brown Jr.
If you want the true love, I've been through the mill of love. Oh,
but Ella's marriage to Ray was coming under strain.
Every love for the true
love. Musically, it was very special, but Ray was like any other musician. He was cute looking, and he was a womanizer.
Despite the ending of their marriage, Ray Brown continued to collaborate with Ella. But another figure came into Ella's life, who would guide her for practically the rest of her career. Norman Granitz.
Well, Norman was a dynamite guy, handsome, clever, and very stylish. Ella and he were partners. They didn't have a contract or a handshake. They were just partners. He said, oh, I'm going to take care, and we're splitting everything down the middle. He bought her a gorgeous mansion. He bought her a sable coat and a Rolls Royce. But it was half her money. He was spending her money, too.
As soon as the contract with Decca expired, for whom Ella had sold 22 million records, Grant signed her to his new label, Verve.
The finest pure vinyl obtainable is forced by hydraulic pressure into a soft plastic.
Up until the early 50s, you were pretty much stuck with the shellac 10-inch 78 record. That was pretty much one song.
Now we're ready to roll. It has taken many steps to get here.
With the invention of the 12-inch vinyl format, the world opened up for recordings. And now collections of songs could be themed. And this was about to offer completely new opportunities to the performers. And Verve's first project with Ella in this new format was to gather together some of the greatest songs that had ever been written in the 20th century. And they began with the sophisticated show tunes of Cole Porter.
But Ella initially found Cole Porter's sophisticated lyrics something of a challenge.
Ella asked me to explain the verse to just one of those things because she didn't exactly understand it.
As Dorothy Parker once said to her boyfriend, fare thee well.
She did not understand exactly who Dorothy Parker was. And I said, she's probably one of the top columnists on Broadway, but she was also a drunk.
As Columbus announced when he knew he was bound, it was swell as a bell.
She said, who is Isabel? I said, Queen Isabella of Spain. Oh, Isabella of Spain.
As Abelard said to Eloise, don't forget to drop a line to me, please.
Shakespeare. But don't forget to drop a line to me, please. It's hysterical.
As Juliet cried in Romeo's ear, Romeo, why not face the fact, my dear?
I was about to explain, said, yeah, I know. It's Shakespeare. I got it. And then she sang it perfectly.
As Dorothy Parker once said to her boyfriend, Fancy Will. As Columbus announced when he knew he was bound, it was well, Isabel's well.
to Eloise. Don't forget to drop a line to me, please. As Juliet cried in a Romeo view, Romeo, why not face the fact, my dear? It was just one of those things, just one of those crazy flames, one of those bells that now and then ring, just one of those things
in the world.
So what we've just finished doing is here in part one and part two on a documentary on Ella Fitzgerald. Bibliography on her life, where now and then you would hear her make various comments, and other notables are making comments also. And we're going to continue with her, but I want to say a few things before we continue. You know, one of the things I remember about Ella was when my father-in-law and I used to sit down and listen to some of her recordings, was the childlike sounding voice that she had. Later on in life, of course, it got more of a straining, childish-like kind of voice because she got older. But when she was in her 30s and 40s in life, what a beautiful sounding, childlike sound she gave. Plus, her rhythm was outstanding. You can't say enough about this remarkable woman. Most people believe that she was the lady of music during her life. And, of course, when you consider some of the other great singers at that particular time, such as Sarah Vaughan, a lot of people I know might put Sarah Vaughan above Ella, but I, myself as a musician, always considered Ella to be a little bit better in the sense that she would make her music sound like something special and without a whole lot of complexity. We're going to go on now and deal with Ella Fitzgerald Part 3.
Ella's co-production book was a massive success, and she followed it with a series of albums in a similar vein.
It was just a period where she made 10 records kind of back to back, which were just, it was perfect, really.
Too marvelous for words.
Wonderful, wonderful music. The period that great songs were composed by great composers. What you might call a dictionary for young people to go to find out a good song to sing.
I do go to the Ella Fitzgerald version just to make sure I've got the attitude of it right, just to make sure I've got the chords right. She worked with the greatest arrangers and the greatest musicians too, so it's like having a textbook for these songs.
The songbooks were a big help in exposing her to the general public as something other than a scat singer or a so-called jazz singer.
You could care less she's a jazz singer. She's Ella Fitzgerald. She was great on her own terms without categorization. That's maybe why Duke Ellington liked her so much. She was beyond category, but perfect.
So there was one category that still remained.
I've got you under my skin. I've got you deep in the heart of me.
Remember, you're looking about a segregated America. She was accepted into white society. Her boys still are fighting for her. They had to open the door for her. They had to. They didn't want to.
I tried so not to give
in. In South, some places, I mean, it was incredible. If you did anything that was wrong, Ella didn't perform, and no one saw to that. You could not segregate the house whatsoever, and that was written into the contract, and they had to honor those. And a few times they didn't, and they made it very unpleasant, but rarely.
the late 1950s, Ella finally got to record with her childhood hero, Amy Armstrong.
The home of sweet when you had a
great. Their voices blend just like syrup.
She just adored him. And he adored her.
They're such effortless records. It sounds like they turned up, got the instruments out, decided what they were going to play it, and literally just played it.
Take a break.
I'm a heart singing while the fire is swinging. Never tired of loving and stopping with you at the
at no point do you think these are not great works of art as well. They don't take themselves too seriously, but the musicianship on it is total perfection.
Nobody in the history of jazz has equaled what Louis Armstrong did. But Ella Fitzgerald got about as close as you can get.
It never seemed like we were really recording because he was always so happy, and I would always mess up because I'd be so fascinated watching him, and he'd be gagging and cracking and making jokes, and you don't know whether he should sing or laugh.
Yeah, one more.
I'm doing Stomping at the Savoy, man. It's fun. You want to go to the Savoy? You want to be at the record date? You want to see what Louis chattering at Norman Grant's in the control booth? You're wondering about Ella. You can tell if you listen to that record. Ella said, this is a little bit too hysterical. This is getting out of hand. And Louis, oh, no, Ella, you got to go completely crazy just like me. And she's like, finally lets it drop, and they just start cracking up.
Don't grab your phone now. Don't grab my story now. Hey, Norman Grant, say one more. You must be looking at Lana Hampton.
I said, we must be tired after all that work. She said, who's working? I was having fun.
This is TWA, flight 905, Bombay, India.
Ella worked an intense schedule, which she struggled to balance with bringing up young Ray June.
The times when we were together, they were fairly intense. It's the sacrifices that all parents have to make. And as a child, of course, we don't always understand it. With the amount of travel that she did, there were some obviously lonely times. She was very concerned about me. And I was spoiled a little bit, okay?
She was so full of guilt that when she used to do certain things, like, oh, she sent him a banjo or a guitar, or she's going to buy him a car. I said, don't you know what you're doing? You've got a guilty conscience because you're not home and you're trying to make up and buy some love. You know, you just knock off a couple of days and stay home.
And she would come off the road and, of course, she would just be exhausted. But, you know, after a couple of weeks, you could just kind of see that itch. It's like, it's time to go back to work, you know?
She was appearing at Costa Mesa. I was telling her, Ella is sold out, which it was. And we were all waiting till the concert started and watching TV in her room. And here comes the news. And in the middle of the news, they said, jazz legend Ella Fitzgerald is performing tonight. Tickets still available. And she looked at me and I said, Ella, I swear to you, it's sold out. And I had to go to the people and tell her it's sold out. And she looked at me and I thought, oh, boy, here we go. I was saying, I don't like to do this. I'm not going to remember the words. I'm not going to remember this. I'm not going to remember that. And she was a mess.
But the moment I hit that stage, it's a different feeling. I get nerves from somewhere. I don't know what it is. But maybe it's because something I love to do. Oh, the shock has early season. And he shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has back his dear. And he keeps it out of sight.
You know, when you got Ella Fitzgerald to drop the formality and even the conformity of what she thought was to be done, she often produced a magic moment. And the other one, of course, would be Mac the Knife in Berlin. You know, the idea is she's going to cover Bobby Darin covering Louis Armstrong. Mm-hmm. That's the idea. And they're going to get in a live album out of this tour, and that's going to be the thing. This is going to be, she's looking for a single. Mac the Knife, and then we recorded it along with an entire program in Germany, and we played six German cities with exactly the same program, and came back to the one in Berlin, which was the first one, and it was because she forgot the lyrics.
Oh, what's the next chorus to this song
And she can't remember the words, so she says, ah, the hell with it, and she turns into a much more casual performer, irreverent even. And it was exceptionally great, and it motivates her to outswing herself, and that's something that's already an event. She could always sing her way out of it. She'd find a rhyme. Look at her. She was very fast. And usually it was better than what what the real words were.
Bobby Darin and Louis Armstrong, they made a record. Ooh, what a record of a song.
We did six versions. The first one's the best one.
Ella's spontaneous performance won the Grammys both for the song and the album.
After the concert, she said, "Do you think the people like me? Do you think the people like me?"
But I think she went through it when she was a kid. That's indelible, unfortunately, to me. That would account for being, I hope they love me. She faced life like an eight-year-old, I think, you know, like a little kid, jingling. I thought she was a charming lady, you know. I mean, I could see all the problems, you know. She wasn't really capable of having a mature relationship. She was lonesome, and she had a couple of boyfriends.
The lonely nights will be over soon.
Ella had begun a transatlantic affair with a younger man, Thor Arthur, who she met on one of her frequent European tours.
I found the happiness I've waited for.
Unusually, Ella spoke about the relationship to the press. She hinted that marriage was a strong possibility, and that Larson had applied to come to the U.S.
Thor Larson was banned from entering the U.S. He'd been convicted in Sweden to 5 months hard labor for stealing money from a former fiancé. And in a way, this seemed to fit the pattern of some of Ella's relationships, although there may be others that were more successful that we don't know about. But there seems to be an unfulfilled quality about her personal life and her private life. Perhaps a quality that she fulfilled as a performer.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Mama.
She seems so felt that she's as grateful for the audience being there as they're grateful to have her there. Maybe that's what a real relationship is about.
Try to think that love's not around, but it's uncomfortable. I ain't gaining no ground, Because my angel eyes.
She could express herself so much more with a ballad if there was if she had a love affair that was going wrong. She would have put whatever was bothering her into one of the songs.
Need I say that my love's misspent with angel eyes tonight?
She's experiencing loss like all the great jazz singers, you know. Are you jazz or are you a human being?
The last and the jazz on me.
Often, you know, jazz on the stage wins and the love life suffers. And the angel eyes have gone away. And I think that when Ella sings about loss, that she's most convincing.
Frank Sinatra sang Angel Eyes, and done just as well by Ella Fitzgerald singing George Gershwin. One of the greatest singers that I've ever heard of, and the improvisations of things that she was able to do to me was unreal. And in the sense that she was able to sing well up in her 70s on the same level, on a consistent basis. Here it is, 17 after 6. We don't have much longer to go, but I really wanted you to hear just her singing, and maybe next week we will come back and talk more about her life. This is the one, part 6. It's not long. It's just enough for us to be able to hear her singing with another great artist who she adored also. Let's give a listen.
Wrong tone, wrong face. Though your face is charming, it's the wrong face. It's not his face, but such a charming face that it's all right with me.
It's the wrong song and the wrong style. Though your smile is lovely, it's the wrong smile. It's not her smile, but such a lovely smile that it's all right with me. You can't know how happy I am that we wait. I'm strangely attracted to you. There's someone I'm trying so hard to forget.
Don't you want to forget someone?
It's the wrong game.
Wrong game.
Wrong chip.
Wrong chip.
No, your lips are tempting. They are the wrong. They're not hers, but they're such tempting.
And if someday you're free, it's
all right.
Well, it's all right.
It's all right.
Pressure.
of constant traveling was taking a toll on Ella's health and her marriage. It was a routine that did not encourage close relationships. She and Ray Brown were separated more than they were together. Finally, they divorced.
She was very upset about it, but you know, she had ideas of doing away with herself. And I says, no, what are you talking about? She just, you have no idea what went through my head when he left. I just, life goes on, you gotta keep going. She says, yeah, I guess I'm gonna have to do that. But she was very upset when he left her.
I wanted to stop there. Ray Brown was a famous bass player. Out of all the men that she was involved with, they had a adopted son who we heard talk a few minutes ago about his mother, who spent a lot of time on the road. I can remember seeing Ella Fitzgerald in Boston, Massachusetts at the Boston Pops. And my wife, who's no longer with us, has passed on. And I had both sat there at the Boston Pops and were astounded by this woman who was in her late 60s at the time, how well she was able to control her voice. While she was standing next to the piano, because of her diabetes, lost the feel in her legs, and when she stepped out, fell on the stage while singing The Girl from Ipanema. What was so remarkable about that experience was watching her get on her feet without missing a beat and continuing to sing was to me one of the most remarkable things that I had ever seen an entertainer, singer, or performer ever do. And it was just remarkable, and I think the audience appreciated all of her efforts. Now, we got about 8 minutes left, or really 7 minutes left. You know, Ella performed with a lot of performers. Not only did she perform that singer that we heard just a few minutes ago, was the great Nat King Cole, who was a jazz singer himself. But Ella also sang with Bing Crosby. We won't be able to listen to everything related to Bing Crosby, but let's see if we can hear her singing with Bing Crosby.
Home in a beautiful home in Beverly Hills, but she was really there.
I've been on the road so much, and I'm very proud of my son for the simple reason he's had to practically raise himself in a way because he's had to use his own judgment in a lot of things. And in spite of that, I can say and knock on wood that he still hasn't really caused me any too much trouble.
You look at her upbringing, the things that went into her life and what she had to go through. All I can say is that she gave to me as much as she could, and she loved me as much as she could, and I always knew, and she always knew, that no matter what, we would be there, you know. Ella paid a heavy price for her career. Ray Jr. left home, and for a while, they were rarely in touch. She began to rely more and more on her audience for the love that was missing in her life. And the audience adored her. She played only the top venues around the world and always packed them. At the first Grammy Awards, Ella won two, a record that stood until she did it again the next year. In her lifetime, she won 13 Grammys and sold over 40 million records. Ella was now a living legend. She joined that rare group of performers who are on the first-name basis with the world, and she enjoyed the company.
A singer like yourself, how do you get started?
Well, the best thing is start out when you know the children's songs.
Oh.
Yeah, do you know the children's songs?
Ella, may I tell you something? I have the largest repertoire of children's songs since Mother Hubbard.
Mm-hmm.
Seemed to thrive on touring, and fans were like family to her. Being on the road made it difficult to have a real family, but she had always remained close to her sister and was devastated when she received a telegram.
Her sister died, and she sent for me a couple of minutes later, and she said, I decided there are children that have to be taken care of and educated. I got to go out there and work, find out the funeral chapel, whatever, and I'll take care of everything. And then she starts to cry. It went way past her having just nieces and nephews. She had an aunt, and she had a cousin. I guess she had many cousins. How many of them she was taking care of, I don't know. But that was a lot of money. And see them reared, and then the girls, you know, would have their separate families, and she would see to that they all had what they needed for their kids.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to Getting It Done with Dr. Walter Dean. We've featured today different segments of Ella Fitzgerald's life. We will continue next week with Ella Fitzgerald, and we will play more of her music. Probably get in a little bit, the first 30 minutes will be a little bit about some more of her life in the later years and some concerts that she might have done or that she did do. And then we will listen to the remarkable voice of Ella Fitzgerald. Hopefully you've enjoyed it as much as I've enjoyed bringing it to you. This has been Getting It Done with your host, Dr. Walter Dean. Have a good weekend.